Good morning. For those of you who are new, I'm Fred Niss. I'm the provost here at EMU. And if you want to know what a provost is, just come and ask me during coffee break. Or talk to any of the old timers around here and they'll give you the straight dope. It's my pleasure and honor to introduce our keynote speaker for this fall's conference. I had the pleasure of meeting her just a few minutes before our program started this morning, but I'd heard about her before from many different places. She's been in increasing demand as a public speaker over the last couple years, and she appropriately protects her time, so I feel very fortunate that she agreed to be with us this summer during our conference. Dr. Christina Cleveland is a social psychologist and a public theologian, and she's author of a very important and widely read book, Disunity in Christ, Discovering the Hidden Forces That Keep Us Apart. And you'll have an opportunity to get a copy of that book if you're interested during the break. Christina is associate professor of the practice of reconciliation at the Duke University Divinity School. To give you a sense of the background that she's coming from as she speaks to us this morning, I want to read you a paragraph from her online bio. As a child growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, Christina was exposed to the richness of cultural difference. The kids on her neighborhood block represented 9 different nationalities, where she quickly discovered that "be there in 5 minutes" means different things depending on who's saying it. At the multi-ethnic church that her parents planted, she learned that different cultures experience and perceive God differently, and that's a good thing. As a sociologist, I was also pleased to read in her bio that she was a sociology undergraduate major at Dartmouth, so I feel like she's a bit of a kindred spirit. She did her doctoral work in social psychology at UC Santa Barbara, and she's currently finishing a second book, The Priesthood of the Privileged, Examining Inequality in the Church. She has a knack for picking good titles for her books. In addition to her academic career of teaching and scholarship, she does a lot of public speaking and writing. She was recently named by Jet Magazine as one of 5 online shepherds to follow. So we're pleased to be able to hear from this shepherd today. She's going to be speaking to us in 2 parts, before and after the coffee break, on the topic of Towards Unity in a World of Division, Theological and Social Psychological Reflections. So please join me in welcoming Christina Cleveland.
What a joy and privilege it is to be here with you all today. This is my first time at EMU, and your provost is right. I don't say yes to very many speaking engagements, but as a reconciliation scholar and practitioner, I thought, how can I not say yes to EMU? You all are masters at this, and I'm excited to be here with you. Ken, thank you so much for that leadership and worship and reflection, and yeah, it was sacred. Thank you. I would love to open us up with just a little bit of prayer. The longer I do reconciliation and justice work, the more I dig deep into my contemplative spiritual practices, because that's what keeps me whole and healthy and moving forward with hope in the midst of lots and lots of despair. So we're going to do just a really brief old Ignatian prayer. You might be familiar with it, the Be Still prayer. And so I'll just say a line out loud, and then you all can repeat after me, and then we'll have a moment of silence where we can contemplate whatever resonates with us in that line, and then I'll just keep going, and it's really self-explanatory. So I will begin. Repeat after me. Be still and know that I am God.
Be still and know that
Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still. Be. Creator and liberator and comforter and friend, shepherd, prophet, confidant, I pray a blessing over this time. Holy Spirit, come and be with us. Thank you for every soul in this room. Thank you for every heart, every story, every fear, every hope. I thank you that you know those things intimately well, and you are speaking to us and challenging us in the ways that we need to be challenged. Thank you for your invitation to listen to the prophetic voices of our time and to participate in the family of God in ways that are beyond our imagination. Give us joy as we talk about who you are on this world, in justice and diversity and equity. In Jesus' name, amen. I am, I have the privilege and maybe the curse of being at the intersection of faith, justice, church, society, and I'm really involved in lots of different places. And the good thing about that is I see some of the best of what the church is doing. The difficult thing is that I see some of the worst of what the church is doing, and I get to hold that intention. And so I'll be able to share a few stories this morning to hopefully enliven your imaginations around this question of difference and equality and inequality. But one of the things that's very common for me is I get hundreds of emails from pastors every month. Most of them are, the most common one is definitely tell me what to preach this Sunday, especially because this summer there's just been so much that we've been dealing with, and pastors are rightfully approaching their sermons with a lot of fear and trepidation. But the second most common email I get, and I do get so many of these, is always an idea, and it's the same bad idea. So like I said, and like as Ken mentioned, this has just been, I mean, we live in a very difficult world sometimes too. It's just as dark as it is light. But this summer, as we've all acknowledged, it's just been incredibly painful and full of division. And oftentimes in response to a police shooting of an unarmed black man or something like that, people will email me with this idea. And they mean well. They really do. They want to bring unity. And so they say, here's what I'm thinking. Everyone in my community is just fraught with division, blacks versus whites. And so I'm thinking dinner for eight at my house with my four white supremacist friends and my four like Black Panther friends. And I just think if we can just get everyone at the same table and talk about it, everything will be better. And my response is always, please don't do that. Someone might get hurt. That's a terrible, terrible idea. But I appreciate the sentiment behind it. I appreciate that you want to bring people together, but that brings up the question of how do we do this? What are the appropriate steps? And thankfully, people usually do that. They usually email me before they make that attempt. And so I think a lot of lives have been saved by me or my assistant just emailing back and being like, shut it down, you know, like this is terrible. But sometimes people make attempts without talking to me, believe it or not, right? And so I once heard about a church in the Midwest that, again, wanted to deal with some of the racial divisions in their community. Good hearts, meant well, wanted to do what was right. And so they decided, this was a predominantly white church, almost exclusively white, and they said, you know, we want to build bridges in our community. There are lots of black churches, predominantly black churches, that have kind of a history of division. Like the Christian community has just really been divided along racial lines, even though it wasn't a very large community. And so this white church said, we are going to create a racial unity night at our church. Again, good intentions. And they said, we're going to do this as by the book as we can possibly do it. Now, I wouldn't recommend this on any level as a social psychologist, but if you're going to do it, this would be the way to do it, but I don't recommend it. So they said, you know, the white pastor said, I'm going to preach a whole sermon series on the biblical basis for diversity. That's great. That should be happening in churches. And they said, we are going to make sure that the planning team for this event is going to be have representation from some of the black churches. Also good to have kind of a diverse planning team. They brought in a local gospel choir to provide some of the music. They said, we are going to have kind of a meal around this. So they got some soul food, also good. And they said, we're even going to organize it so that half the tickets are sold to white churches and half the tickets are sold to black churches to make sure that there's actual diversity at the event. And they said, we're not even going to have tables that that are regular height with chairs. We're just going to have bar height tables and people won't have chairs and they'll be forced to mingle. So that way, hopefully, we'll get some interaction going. I happened to be in town when this event happened, and far be it from me to see, to look away when there's like a train wreck. So I definitely went. And I was like, I just want to see what's going to happen here because it's not going to be good. And I walked in. And I was a few minutes late, but as I got in, all the black people were on one side of the room, and all the white people were on the other side of the room. It was almost as if there was like an invisible wall in between the two groups. And I thought to myself, well, it could be worse, right? I mean, but the fact of the matter is the whole point of this event was to bring people together, to share in racial unity, and something was missing. And so I went over to the white people and I said, hey, white people, why are you not talking to the black people? And they said, well, we thought that they don't want to talk to us. And then I went over to the black people and I said, hey, black people, why are you not talking to the white people? And they said, well, they're over there because they don't want to talk to us. And I thought, well, everyone bought a ticket so they could come and make a friend from another race. I mean, that was the point. You paid your $20, go get your friend. I mean, that's how I think as a consumer and an American and stuff like that, right? I mean, but the power of disunity is so strong that even when we mean well, even when we intend to, even when our hearts are in the right place, we find ourselves either in passively divisive situations like that one, or even potentially explosive situations. And even though that's a little bit of a funny story, what that event actually contributed to was deeper disunity. And actually, research shows that if people are not brought together under the right circumstances, prejudice will actually increase, hostility will actually increase, group division will actually increase. So it's not just about bringing people together. It goes so much deeper than that. But you know, it makes sense. It makes sense that we would be divided in the way that we are for so many reasons, based on the way we categorize each other, based on the way homogeneity affects our perceptions of each other. But one of the things I want to focus on in this first part before we go a lot deeper in the second part after the break is why divisions make sense for our identity. We live in a diverse world, a pluralistic world, a world that's quite frankly really confusing. There are all sorts of humans. There are all sorts of entities that are not humans. We are cognitive misers, and so we have very limited cognitive energy. And so we just can't manage all of the data that we encounter on a daily basis. And so we naturally group with people who are like us. We naturally make sense of our world and organize it along group identities. And that makes so much sense in so many ways, because my experience as a relatively young, I'll say a millennial, African-American, professional, urban, single Christian woman is so distinct in our broader society, it makes the most sense for me to want to gather around people who share all those identities, that same cocktail of identities, because they can affirm who I am. They can make me feel like I'm okay in our world that's so different than me. And they laugh at my jokes, and I start a sentence, and they finish a sentence, and everything is just very easy. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And so we often group around these, we often group with people who are like us, and we build an identity around that. And we say, yeah, you're one of my people. You're like me. We share theology. We share a perspective in the world. We shop the same way. We talk the same way. And in a lot of ways, that's not really bad. That's just groupishness. It helps us survive in our world. But because we are so interested in maintaining our distinct identities, we often look at other groups and say, well, we're so different than them, because we want to maintain the boundaries of our identity so that we can understand where we are in relation to everyone else in the world. And that's where it starts to get really sticky for us when it comes to group identities. It'd be different if I could just say, yeah, I'm me and you're you, but that's not enough. I need to say, I'm me and you're you, which is so different from me, because I don't want to confuse me with you. Because then where would I be? How would I know how I relate to the world, where I'm located in our world? I just moved to the Research Triangle in North Carolina this time last summer. But prior to that, I spent 5 years in Minnesota. And is anyone here from Minnesota besides my friend who's here with me? Oh, great. Okay, hopefully I won't offend you. But Minnesotans. So I moved to Minnesota from Santa Barbara, where I had done my PhD, and I'd also been a faculty member for a few years at Westmont College. That was my first job. And I moved to Minnesota in the summer of 2010. And Minnesotans, they are kind of obsessed with the weather. They talk about the weather all the time. And I was not accustomed to that, because when I was in California, we pretty much only talked about the weather when there was nothing else to talk about. You know, like you've exhausted every other possible conversation topic, and so you talk about the weather. That's not the case in Minnesota. There might be natural disasters going on, major wars, major presidential elections, and Minnesotans will bypass all of that to talk about the weather. That's just how passionate they are about it. So when I first got there, it became very clear to me that Minnesotans are very proud of their hard winters. And I learned this because I would show up and I'd say, hi, I'm new. I just moved here from Santa Barbara. You just moved here from Santa Barbara? Yes, I did. Well, have you experienced a Minnesota winter? Nope, it's July, just moved here. And the response was always the same: you're going to die. And so this happened 15 times in my first month. So one day I was at Trader Joe's, which is a grocery store, and I was going through the checkout line, and the checker kind of started this conversation. They're supposed to be friendly at Trader Joe's. So he's like, oh, what's your story? And I'm like, oh, I just moved here from Santa Barbara. Oh my gosh, have you been through a Minnesota winter? No, you're going to die. So, you know, I had heard this over and over again. So I was starting to get a little snarky, and my group identity was starting to take hits, because I was thinking, now, wait a second. I went to school in New Hampshire. I went to boarding school and college in New Hampshire, and it's pretty cold there. So I'm pretty sure I can handle these winters. And his response was, oh no, it's way worse here than in New Hampshire. And so then I said, well, when did you live in New Hampshire so you could compare and contrast the winters? And he's like, I never never even been in New Hampshire. I'm just telling you that the winters here are worse. Meanwhile, there are three Minnesotans in line behind me, and they're getting invested in this too. And they're like, I'm telling you, it's a wet winter here, and blah, blah, blah. And it just chills you to the bones and this and that. And I was like, oh my gosh. And we're going back and forth and back and forth for about 10 minutes. And then finally, it occurred to me, I thought, gosh, does someone have to win this conversation? Because the fact of the matter is I spent 7 years in New Hampshire, and you all have grown up in Minnesota, and we have way more in common than if we've all been through really hard winters. We should really just do a group hug right here, because we've all survived the winters. But isn't that the power of group identity? We want to distinguish ourselves from others so we can keep our world organized, keep our identity organized, and know, well, hey, who am I as a New Hampshire person if I'm just like the Minnesotans? That's not okay. Who am I as a Mennonite if I'm just like the Brethren? Who am I if I'm a Methodist if I'm just like the Nazarites? Nazarites, no, Nazarenes. Not the Nazarites, there is a difference. Who am I as a Republican if I'm a lot like the Democrats? Who am I as a Black person if I'm a lot like the Asian people that I know? You know, there's a book that's getting a lot of press right now that came out last month. I read it a couple weeks ago during the RNC. It's called Hillbilly Elegy. Some of you may have heard about it, especially if you're a social scientist, and it's written by, it's a fascinating book because it's about white poverty in Kentucky, but it's written from a first-person perspective by someone who so-called got out and ended up getting going to Yale Law School, and it's also written from a conservative perspective, which I think is interesting because most books on poverty that I read are written from a more progressive perspective, so it's interesting to read that. But one of the things that's fascinating about it is the culture that he's describing is stricken by inequality in ways that are almost exactly the same as low-income Black, the low-income Black community. And so it's fascinating to think that the way that he, the author, has sort of created this group identity around poor white people as distinct from poor Black people is so interesting to me because it shows this power of group identity and how we want to distinguish ourselves. And it's interesting to see how politicians, one politician in particular, has really tapped into that and saying, whites are different than Blacks. Let's divide and conquer, when really whites and Blacks, the vast majority of us, should probably be banding together because we have a lot more in common than difference, particularly those who come from socioeconomically oppressed backgrounds. And so this is powerful, the way that we divide ourselves. It's not to say that differences don't matter. I'm not arguing for colorblindness, so to speak. But what gets even more difficult as we deal with division is we try to think about how do we overcome it, and specifically how do we overcome it in a theological way, how do our practices come in line with our theology, is it's not so much that we just say we are so different than them, we are so distinct from them, but because group identity is so closely intertwined with self-esteem, we are so different than them quickly devolves into we are better than them. We almost don't notice how quickly it switches. Self-esteem is one of those strange constructs. So many social psychological constructs are difficult to define. I mean, like, what is love? What is consciousness? What is the self? Who knows, right? But self-esteem is kind of like that. And social psychologists don't really agree on what self-esteem is. Some believe that it has more to do with affect, how we feel about ourselves. Some think it has more to do with cognition. What do we think about ourselves, or how do we evaluate ourselves? But the thing we all agree on is that it's immensely important. We will do anything we can to maintain our self-esteem. We will be irrational. We will interpret ambiguous situations in ways that always make us look good because we want to maintain our self-esteem. And Westerners are extremely good at maintaining self-esteem. On average in the United States, we have a self-esteem of about a 7.6 on a scale of 1 to 10. with 10 being the highest. So we tend to feel good about ourselves, and that's good. I mean, self-esteem is a great buffer for a lot of things, and it's related to a lot of positive health outcomes. And so it's not bad to do that. But the fact of the matter is we have a lot of built-in biases to help us maintain that high self-esteem. For example, you all work with undergrads, so I'm sure you understand this. When I was last year before I went to Duke, I taught at Bethel University in St. Paul. And if I gave an exam and a student failed that exam, who was to blame for that? Who did the student blame? Me, right? I'm at fault. I'm trying to ruin their GPA. I'm staying up all night long thinking up trick questions simply to ruin their GPA. I did not explain the material clearly enough. I am just terrible, right? I mean, there are lots of reasons why. And so students would come to me and, you know, I would get these accusations and I wasn't even mad about it because I'm a social psychologist and I'm like, oh, you're just maintaining your self-esteem. That's sweet. I don't take it personally. It's not personal. We all do this. But the thing is if on the next exam they do well, who gets the credit for that? No student has ever come to me and said, Dr. Cleveland, it is because of your brilliance as an instructor that I am thriving in this class, right? It's always like, well, I worked really hard. I mastered the material. I'm just smart. And so that's just a natural way that we have built in biases to maintain our self-esteem. We do this often in the way that we compare ourselves to other people, just interpersonally. If someone comes up to me and says, you know, how smart do you think you are on a scale of 1 to 10? I'm not going to think of Albert Einstein as my point of comparison because that would make me feel like I'm maybe a 3 on a scale. I'm instead going to choose someone who makes me seem smart. So I'll say, well, compared to Kim Kardashian, I'm like a 12 on a scale of 1 to 10, right? And so we choose who we want to compare ourselves to. This is natural. We don't even think about it. It's just a non-conscious way that we maintain self-esteem. That's great. The downside is that our self-esteem is intertwined with our group membership. And so now we want to feel good about our group because our group informs our self-esteem. And if we feel good about our group, we feel good about ourselves. If we don't feel good about our group, we don't feel good about ourselves. One of my favorite studies that illustrates this so poignantly and in a way quite frighteningly, took place at Williams College in Massachusetts, a very prestigious liberal arts college. And the researchers there were really interested in looking to see, does self-esteem get a boost if we derogate someone from a different group? There is a lot of research leading up to it that suggested that that would be the case, but this study, which was conducted in the 90s, was one of the first to actually experimentally demonstrate this. And the way they did this was they used a bogus IQ test, which some of you may be familiar with. I'll explain it. But they brought in a group of all students. They were all white. They were all female, and they all identified as Christian. So they're creating kind of an in-group. There's a Christian group here, identity. And they gave everyone in the study a bogus IQ test, which is basically just an IQ test, but you don't grade it at all, and it's randomly predetermined whether the person fails or succeeds on the IQ test. And college students like to think of themselves as really smart, so if you tell them that they failed the IQ test, then you're guaranteed to get a significant decrease in their self-esteem. It's a way to manipulate self-esteem. Social psychology is great because you can use a lot of deception, which as someone who's a pastor's kid, it's nice to know that ethically I can be deceptive. So I love doing research like this. So they brought these women into the lab. Everyone took the test. Half were told you failed. You know, so then the feedback is really fascinating. So the ones who succeeded, they were like, oh, you know, you scored at the 99th percentile. Makes perfect sense that you're here at Williams. You really are the best and the brightest. The people who failed, they were told you scored at the 30th percentile. How did you get in here? Like, are you doing okay here at Williams? You're quite an aberration. So they're really they're really telling them that they're not smart. And And so you see the predicted decreases in self-esteem. So then this is great. You have people with deflated self-esteem and you want to know, what are they going to do to try to increase their self-esteem? Because this is uncomfortable for us. We don't like to feel badly about ourselves. So then they said, we're going to change. That's the end of that study. It's a completely new study, which is social psychology for this is exactly the same study. And we're still observing you. And so they came in and they said, now we're going to do something different. We want to gauge how hiring managers make decisions about people that they might hire. And so we want you to look at a resume, and we're going to give you a job description and a picture of this person. We want you to decide whether you would hire this person, whether they're qualified for the job, whether you think they would work, whether they would succeed at this job, and also some personal questions like, do they seem like a nice person? Would you want to hang out with them? Would you be friends with them? And what they did was they showed everyone the exact same resume in terms of content. So this is someone who is highly qualified for the job. Under normal circumstances, everyone should want to hire this person. All they did was they changed the identity of the applicant. And so half the people in the study got an applicant who was an in-group member, another Christian woman. And this was, they saw the picture and she had a cross around her neck. And the other people got an applicant who was a Jewish woman, an out-group member. And it was the same picture, same person, but she had a Star of David around her neck. So these are the symbols that she's not one of us versus one of us. And they found that people who had deflated self-esteem because they had just flunked this IQ test rated the Jewish woman significantly more negatively than the Christian woman. But people who had high self-esteem rated them equally because they were actually equal, right? And so if you have high self-esteem, for the most part, you're like, oh, everyone's great, in-group member, out-group member, doesn't matter. If I have low self-esteem, I want to feel good about myself. And so I'm going to say the woman who's not like me is not qualified for this job. And I actually wouldn't even want to be friends with her. She doesn't seem that interesting. And then they measured their self-esteem. Does derogating the out-group member actually help? And they found that people who had deflated self-esteem and had derogated the Jewish woman saw an increase in their self-esteem that put them at even higher than their global average, just any day of the week self-esteem, and also higher than right before coming into the study. And so it works. It works. When we put other people down, we feel good about ourselves. When we put other group members down, we feel good about ourselves. And what's fascinating about this study and a little scary is that they didn't do anything that we would call explicitly racist or anti-Semitic. No one said, let's torch the local Jewish temple, right? No one said, let's get rid of all the kosher food in the dining hall. No one did anything that we would say, hey, that's racist. They just said, she's not that smart. She's not that qualified. She wouldn't really fit in here. She's not that interesting. And you see these massive increases in self-esteem. We social psychologists talk sometimes about infrahumanization when we're talking about intergroup relations and how we often boost our group's sense of self, identity, and self-esteem at the expense of other groups. And we do it in such a tricky way, sneaky way, that we don't even know that we're doing it because we don't even have to explicitly mention the other group. The way infrahumanization works, it's a subtle form of dehumanization, is to ascribe uniquely human characteristics to ourselves, to our group. The implication being that the other group does not have these uniquely human characteristics. The implication being that this other group is less human than we are. So, for example, we might ascribe higher order cognitive processes to our group. We might ascribe rationality and logic to our group. And so I hear this often. Even just this week, after looking at some of the in quotes riots happening in Milwaukee in response to yet another police shooting of a black man, where folks were destroying a lot of property and a lot of unruly behavior. And I hear oftentimes people who are not from that neighborhood, either due to class or race, saying, why aren't, you know, we look at this logically and rationally. The implication being those folks who are rioting are not. The implication being they're less human than we are. This is a logic and rationality. It's a uniquely human. Or sometimes when I was living in a low-income, predominantly Black neighborhood in North Minneapolis, I would hear middle-class folks saying things like, I would feel guilty if I were relying on the government as much as some people are. And guilt and shame are uniquely human characteristics. If we don't feel guilt, we're like sociopathic. And so to say, well, I would feel guilty. And it's interesting because we see it the other way too. I roll with people who are pretty passionate about justice. So sometimes I hear some of my friends or myself saying things like, wow, those people who call themselves Christians living in the suburbs with all those extra bedrooms, I'd feel guilty. I mean, with the refugee crisis and everything going on, the implication being they don't feel guilty. They can't feel guilty. They're less human. And my self-esteem, our self-esteem gets a boost. In these very subtle ways, oftentimes, because our identities are usually rooted in this need to make sense of our world and this need to locate ourselves in that world, we find our identities are primarily rooted in things like race and class and gender and sexuality and theology and denomination and educational affiliation, rather than in our broader, equally important, perhaps superordinate identities as humans, as members of the family of God. But we're joking, and this is where I want to transition into talking about something that's a little bit harder to wrestle with. We're joking if we say that these divisions happen equally and reciprocally. Certainly, every human being can participate in these self-esteem and identity processes. Certainly, every human being can categorize other groups, can develop stereotypes of other groups, can say we're better than them, can become ethnocentric, can cling to people who are just like them at the expense of connecting with others. But what often gets left out of this conversation, although I don't think you all will be leaving it out, as I was looking at the workshops this afternoon, I saw there was one on white fragility, and I was like, wow, they're going there? Great. So if you don't know what white fragility is, you should go to the workshop. Actually, you should just go to the workshop. But whether you know it about it all, but one of the things that we often leave out of this conversation is the reality that not all divisions are created equal. Not all divisions are between me and just someone I disagree with, or one group that has approximately the same amount of power and influence and voice as another group. More often than not, divisions are across power lines. And so with the example of the church that I gave earlier, where this white church was trying to bring together unity with a Black church, one of the things they didn't take into account was, well, what are the differences in power between this white church and the Black church? And what are the historical and current realities that impact our division, that impact our relationship here? So then what does it mean to bridge unity, to bridge gaps in a world that's full of division, unless we look at what's the nature of this division? Because certainly we can all participate in these self-esteem processes, but they don't have the same consequence. My brother, who just graduated from Yale Divinity School and is a young minister, can talk firsthand about how these divisions impact him as a Black man. And I know last year when he was at Yale Divinity School and lived 1.5 blocks from the Divinity School in New Haven, he got stopped by the police 4 times on his way home from class in less than 1 academic year, simply for being a black man. And I wonder then, why do we talk about divisions as if they're all equal? Because some people are much more negatively impacted by our divisions than others. And this has to do with power. So my question for myself theologically and for this group here is, what is the role of the powerful in bridging the gap? What do we do in bringing unity in our church, in our school, and in the broader society? I'm going to, before we move to the break, I'm going to share a little bit about my own story, because I want you all to know where I'm coming from in this conversation and where I sort of locate myself. And then also I want to talk a little bit about the role that Jesus has played. But I certainly can identify with lots of oppressed groups. I'm black. I'm a woman. I can, you know, there are a few other ways that I can probably identify with oppressed groups. But I can also identify with groups that have, in a lot of ways in our society, been accommodated, have been welcomed, have been given a voice, given a chance to speak. So, for example, I'm here standing in front of you at your faculty staff conference. You're all listening to me. I have a captive audience here. And I'm invited to speak all over the place. And I have several book contracts, and people read my book, and people read my blog, and people want to know what I think about things, and I have a voice, and I have influence, and I have opportunities. And oftentimes when I talk to my students about this, they say, well, you earn that. You deserve to have a voice. Because I often contrast my voice with the voices of some of my neighbors who are low income, many of whom are on public assistance, many of whom are informally educated, many of whom are more brilliant and have more astute observations about the world than I do, but no one ever invites them to speak or wants to give them a book contract or wants to hear what they think about really anything. And so I say, well, what about them? And my students are like, no. Like, you worked hard for this. You deserve to have more of a voice than other people. And I'm like, oh, actually, yeah, I did work hard for it. I was there for the all-nighters. I wrote my dissertation. I did it. It's true. However, there's something that everyone needs to know about my story that also contributes to where I am in the world now. And my parents are pastors. They're actually kind of pastors of pastors now. But they were pastors of people when I grew up. And we grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. Not that pastors aren't people. Pastors are people too. But there are two things that my parents care about. Jesus is one, and the other is education. That's pretty much it, I will say. And so we learned a lot about Jesus growing up. But also when my dad went to Yale, he grew up in Compton, but for a lot of reasons, he went to, he has his own path, but he went to Yale, his brother went to Princeton. And so they decided to raise their kids. So there's 6 of us. I have 2 siblings and I have 3 cousins. So there's 6 of us. And so they decided to raise us in a way that would set us up to go to schools like Yale and Princeton. So when I was in first grade, we started studying for the SATs. I came home from school. I was already in the accelerated classes, so I had to stay an extra hour after school for like accelerated reading. Then I would come home, do my homework, and then I'd have an hour and a half of SAT prep work that my dad had assigned for me. He got these workbooks. And so I didn't know I was studying for the SAT at the time, but when I took the SAT 10 years later, I was like, wow, this is remarkably familiar. And so I had literally been studying for it for 10 years, an hour and a half every day. And on Saturdays, beginning in 3rd grade, I went to Science Academy at UC Berkeley, because my parents signed us up for that. So I would get on the BART train, ride into UC Berkeley, walk up the hill, to the chemistry building, and I would be in the lab all day long. And it was a special program for kids of color, and all of the teachers were UC Berkeley undergrads of color. And so I was being taught by people who looked like me, and I was learning my way around UC Berkeley's campus and getting a feel for university life. And at home was kind of like a college campus too. My dad went to Yale, like I said, so we had Yale everything. Yale toothbrushes, Yale towels, Yale sleeping bags, Yale sweatshirts, you name it, it said Yale. And every night at the dinner table, my dad would make us go around and recite the 8 Ivy League schools so that we knew where we were going one day. And my parents lied to us, and this is brilliant if I ever have kids. They told us that in the summertime, the only thing that's open is the library. And so they were lying. And we believed it because we were sheltered. And so school was closed, so it made sense. Well, school's closed, so everything must be closed, but the library is open. And so we would get up in the morning and have breakfast, and then spend the whole day at the library, come home for dinner. And it wasn't until after dinner that we got to play on the street with our friends. So that was just our normal routine. My parents also wanted us to be cultured, in quotes. And so we had season tickets to the San Francisco Opera, Ballet, and Symphony. And every month as a family, we would get all dressed up and we would go and go to Davies Hall in San Francisco. And we would have these experiences. And then we'd go out to dinner and talk about them. And so when I was a sophomore in high school, my parents helped me apply to go to Phillips Exeter Academy, and I went there, and that's where I ended up graduating from high school. And then, of course, I applied to college from Exeter and had my pick of the ones to go to, and so I ended up at Dartmouth. And when I think about it, I think, wow, I fell into Dartmouth. I was Dartmouth bound from the moment I was conceived, because in all the ways that I took a step forward, society, that would be my family, community, and also the broader community, was there to support me. When I needed a tutor for geometry, I got a tutor. When I needed extra help in a class, I could call up my uncle who had gone to Princeton. And I think about my friends, particularly in my neighborhood in North Minneapolis, that even though I don't live there, they're still close to me psychologically and in my heart and via phone and FaceTime. I think about so many of my buddies there who had every bit as much desire and smarts and hopes and goals. And in every way that I was supported by my educational system, much of which was public, but I grew up in a middle-class town that had decent public schools. In every way that my education was supported, in every way that my hopes and dreams were supported, theirs were thwarted. The high school 4 blocks from my house, my condo in Minneapolis, does not have any extracurriculars. If they want to play sports, they have to take a bus to a school 30 blocks away and be on their sports teams. They don't have any electives. So there are no modern languages, there are no arts, there's no music. And actually, as I was mentoring some of the girls on my block and doing this thing that we started to call Breakfast Club, I realized that you could graduate from that high school, you could successfully graduate from that high school, public high school, and fulfill every single requirement and still not have the classes you would need to apply to a school like Eastern Mennonite University, because the public school simply does not offer the classes that are needed to get into a 4-year college. And so I think, what does this mean for me? What does this mean for someone who was born into a family? I'm one of the 11% of people in the United States who are born to two parents with a college education. We're more than 3 times as likely to go to college than people who are not born, the 89%. What does this mean for me, someone who was born into a family, supported in at every step of the way, not only by my family, but by the broader society? Because once you become the formally educated, society just accommodates you. If you were paying attention at all to the DNC, speeches, they were only speaking to middle-class people and higher. So as the formally educated, they were speaking to me. Society accommodates me. Politicians want my vote. They want to cater to me and people that are higher than me socioeconomically, while alienating folks who have not had access to education, have not had the support that I naturally received. One of my students, of course, let me say this before I say what one of my students said. Obviously, I'm talking from my personal perspective of what it means to be someone for whom society accommodates, for whom once you get on this track, the sky really is the limit. You probably can do whatever you want to do. But obviously, I'm not the only person. People who are formally educated, people who are middle class and higher, are not the only people for whom society accommodates, of course, right? I mean, whites are the big group that society accommodates. Men, of course, Christians, Americans, English speakers, people who have citizenship here in the United States, for example, Westerners, heterosexuals, you name it, able-bodied, the mentally able. There are so many for whom society accommodates. But we were talking about white people in my class at Bethel, and one of my students said, okay, so I kind of get it. We had just talked about how if you are white, well, if you just actually have a white-sounding name, you're more likely to be hired for jobs than if you have a black-sounding name. You might be familiar. It's a very famous study that was first published in 2004, where they wanted to see if just the name affected your chances of being hired. So they sent out 500 resumes to over, I think, 16 different metropolitan areas. And the resume was exactly the same. The resume was always really qualified for the job. They only changed the name on the resume. So they had two white resumes. They had Emily and Greg, white sounding names. And then they had Jamal and Lakeisha for the black sounding names. And Emily and Greg were twice as likely to be called in for an interview than Jamal and Lakeisha. Exact same resume, exact same qualifications. And so it was in the context of this that my students were wrestling, and you have to love undergrads. They're so earnest and maybe a little too honest. One of them said, well, isn't that black people's own fault for naming their kids such weird names? I mean, what do you expect? Of course, people are not going to want to hire you when you have a weird name like that. And I said, yes, Mackenzie. Jamal and Lakeisha is a really weird name. And so we kind of had this conversation about, I said, that is exactly what we're talking about. That is white privilege. White people get to decide what is normal and what is not. White people get to decide what is alien and what is not. White people just get to decide what is safe and what is not. It's all relative, and the group that has power gets to decide when it is. And so we were talking a lot about this concept of white privilege, and one student said, so then does this make me inherently at fault because I'm white? In the same way, does growing up in your family with college-educated parents make you inherently at fault for the inequality that we experience and we see around us? And I said, no. You are not inherently at fault for being white, but you have inherited a fault as a white person. And the question for someone like me, I've inherited a fault along class lines. I'm not inherently at fault, but I have inherited a fault. So then what then do I do? I'm going to read Philippians 2:1-11 for us. This is obviously a famous passage. This poem of Jesus in kenosis and incarnation has been studied for centuries. I'm going to read this actually from the Voice translation, which biblical scholars, forgive me, I know it's not a real translation, but just bear with me. Just let it sink in. If you find any comfort from being in Jesus the Anointed, if God If God's love brings you some encouragement, if you experience true companionship with the Holy Spirit, if God's tenderness and mercy fill your heart, then sisters and brothers, here is one thing that would complete my joy. Come together as one in mind and spirit and purpose, sharing in the same love. Don't let selfishness and prideful agendas take over. Embrace true humility and lift your heads to extend love to others. Get beyond yourselves and protecting your own interests. Be sincere and secure your neighbor's interests first. In other words, adopt the mindset of Jesus the Anointed. Live with his attitude in your hearts. Remember, though he was in the form of God, he chose not to cling to equality with God, but he poured himself out to fill a vessel brand new. A servant in form and a man indeed, the very likeness of humanity. He humbled himself, obedient to death, a merciless death on the cross. So God raised him up to the highest place and gave him the name above all. So when his name is called, every knee will bow in heaven, on earth, and below. And every tongue will confess Jesus, the Anointed One, is Lord, to the glory of God, our Father. Quickly, before we go to break, I want to point out just a couple of things about this passage. And like, it's so rich, and I'm very lucky because I have a few colleagues at Duke who specialize in this passage and have shared so many wonderful insights with me. One of the things that's neat about this is Paul's talking to the Philippian church, which is a really diverse church. And he, at the very beginning, sets us up for a love that's a really high bar, because in the first verse, he very subtly but powerfully notes the Trinity. He mentions being in the Anointed Jesus, he mentions God's love, and he mentions true companionship with the Holy Spirit. So he's talking about the Trinity. He's talking about the unity of the Trinity as the framework with which we're supposed to understand unity amongst us. And theologians, of course, use the term perichoresis to describe the mutual interiority of the Trinity, the ways in which the members of the Trinity are distinct in their identities. They maintain their group identity, their individual identities, their group identities, but they have so much mutuality in that each identity informs the other identity. Each identity overlaps with the other identity, so much so that the Father is only the Father due to his relationship with the Son. The Spirit is only the Spirit because the Spirit is in relationship with the Son and with the Father. They cease to exist. They cease to make sense as we know them, separate from each other. That's the level of interdependence, of mutuality that they share. And this is what Paul is saying. Paul is saying is, if you get this, if you understand this love, this perichoresis love of the Trinity, then you will be united. You will be one in mind and spirit and purpose. But he quickly points out that self-esteem, group identities can get in the way. He says, don't let selfishness and prideful agendas take over. It's not about feeling good about your group. It's not about feeling good about yourself. And then what he does is he points to Jesus as our example. And so I think I'm going to stop there so we can pick up looking at what Jesus did and then what that means for us practically as we seek to follow Jesus's example. Thank you.